painful, just less profitable for their investors, and they're choosing not to.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of Chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعاً إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Ukraine says it plans to evacuate more civilians from Mariupol after dozens were brought to safety out of a besieged steel plant in the city. The UN says over 23 million people in Yemen are in need of humanitarian assistance, an increase of almost 3 million people compared to 2021. And Muslims in several countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Ukrainian authorities are planning to evacuate more civilians from the besieged city of Mariupol after dozens were brought to safety on Sunday. Kiev says roughly 100 civilians have been evacuated from the plant where they had been trapped for weeks. Some estimates put the number of civilians still in the plant at more than 500. The UN and the Red Cross are involved in the evacuation operation. A number of Ukrainian soldiers are also hunkered down in the plant, which is under a siege by Russian forces. Russia recently declared victory in Mariupol as it is advancing in eastern and southern Ukraine. Kiev has asked Western powers to deliver more heavy weapons to bolster its defenses in the east. Russia says it has targeted a supply of Western weapons in southern Ukraine. That comes as the U.S. and its allies continue to send weapons to Ukraine despite repeated warnings by Russia to stop that. Moscow argues that the military aid raises the risk of a direct confrontation between Russia and the West. In the following report, we'll take a look at the escalating tensions over Ukraine.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the U.S. and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, U.S. State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the US and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
The United Nations has warned of a deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen that needs to be addressed immediately. To discuss that further in the News Review program, we were joined by our guests who shared with us their views on the story. Here's more.
Sign up for News Review segments where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The United Nations has warned of a deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen that needs to be addressed immediately. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Yemen, David Gressley, said in a statement that over 23 million people, or almost three quarters of Yemen's population, now need assistance. That's an increase of almost 3 million people from 2021. However, he said a fragile two-month truce, which was held since early April, could help reverse the situation. He urged donors and aid agencies to take advantage of the UN-brokered ceasefire to scale up life-saving assistance and reach out to more people in need. He said the UN needs around $4.3 billion for its 2022 humanitarian response plan for Yemen. The Saudi-led war on Yemen and its blockade of the country has devastated the nation, leaving millions of Yemenis in urgent need of humanitarian aid. Joining us for more on this story is Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, and also Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist from Toronto. Gentlemen, welcome. Robert, the UN official, the UN humanitarian coordinator for Yemen, David Gressley, this is a man who has traveled across Yemen extensively. So he has firsthand experience as the devastating situation. And he's spoken openly about the schools and the hospitals and the infrastructure and other services, vital services that have been destroyed. So he's a source of that we can rely on. Why are we seeing a lack of international action again to what the UN calls the world's largest humanitarian crisis?
Unfortunately, we're seeing it because it's the people of Yemen. You'll notice that in Ukraine right now, there is a great outpouring of support around the world because that's what is currently fashionable. Many commentators have stated that the people of Ukraine, this is they have shockingly said that this isn't a third world country, that this is a European country, and how horrible it is to be happening there. And they're ignoring the same things and 10 times worse that are happening in Yemen. That's because it's not a European, mainly Christian country. It's racism at its worst. Also, the fact that the United States supports the war in Yemen and will continue to support Saudi Arabia's onslaught, that's another reason why these atrocities are being ignored. I'm very happy that the truce is holding and is getting some aid to people, but it's nowhere near what's needed. The people of Yemen have been suffering horribly for years. The world governments could end this suffering, and they refuse to do so. This truce and any aid that gets in now is certainly necessary, but it's not going to resolve the problem.
Right. Eric, what's your take on this? International rights groups and agencies have repeatedly said that starvation has been used as a weapon of war against the people of Yemen.
Well, to me, it's a very kind of confused war, because there doesn't seem to be any clear focus on the Saudi side. And the U.S. is switching tracks and going from one crisis to another. There's a real kind of muddle about what's happening. The Houthi have been showing their strength with their drones and their defiance of Saudi demands, and then the Saudis they gave 163 prisoners, Houthi prisoners. So the Saudi have been making what appear to be serious attempts in recent days to reach some kind of accord. I don't know if they're being counseled by the U.S. or if they're doing this on their own. It's a very confused situation, but that does look better. The Houthi have not disappeared. They're strong. They're defiant. And the Saudis have backed off and allowed the port to operate, Hodeidah port. There are now a flow of energy, of resources coming in. So things are looking better. So I think we really have to just wait and see what happens over the next few weeks. I think something good really should happen. I'm maybe optimistic, but I don't see any real push to try and end the Houthis as a force. That they can't, the Saudis can't do that. So they seem to be willing to negotiate. So I'm hopeful that something will happen positively in the next week or two.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Let me thank our guests for their time. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist who joined us from Kitchener, and Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist, joining us from Toronto. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. Muslims in over a dozen Islamic countries are celebrating Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Turkey, Yemen, Palestine, and most Persian Gulf Arab countries, as well as nations in North Africa, have announced Monday as Eid al-Fitr. Muslims follow a lunar calendar, and difference in sighting of the moon can lead to communities marking the occasion on different days. On Monday, tens of thousands of the faithful gathered for communal prayers in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after the city's main mosque opened to the ritual for the first time since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. Several countries, including Afghanistan and Mali, marked the on Sunday. Other Islamic countries, including Iran and Iraq, expected to mark the occasion on Tuesday. A missile attack has struck an oil refinery in Erbil, the capital city of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. Fire broke out after an oil tank was hit in the attack, but was brought under control later on. According to a statement by local authorities, several projectiles were launched from Nineveh province targeting the car refinery. No casualties were reported in the statement. There's been no claim of responsibility yet. On April 6th, three missiles fell near the same refinery. A number of European cities report clashes between police and demonstrators during rallies marking International Labor Day, also known as May Day. In the German capital, Berlin, police faced up with around 10,000 demonstrators, most of them dressed in black. Several people were detained there during scuffles with the police. In neighboring France, security forces fired tear gas to disperse demonstrators in Paris. French police also arrested several people, voicing anger at rising unemployment.
International Workers' Day was celebrated in France with hundreds of marches nationwide as leftists of all sorts united to celebrate equality, solidarity, and worker empowerment.
The 1st of May is the international day for workers to get together and discuss how to defend themselves. It's seemingly the only day where workers mobilize for their rights worldwide, and we see how there are so many countries represented here. Today is more important than any election or particular movement.
In 2020 and 2021, May Day was muted due to the coronavirus pandemic. The celebration is back to full strength this year, and many marchers have an added reason to be politically active. The recent re-election of Emmanuel Macron following a campaign dominated by the far right. Economic stagnation, record inflation, a bitter election campaign with results few are genuinely happy about. Many believe some changes are coming for France. The French left is in the middle of perhaps a major reconstitution. The communists, greens, and socialists are deciding whether or not to join forces behind Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who finished third in the presidential race. Should they unite for the June legislative elections, they could deny Macron absolute control of parliament and thus drastically change his plans for his second term.
I can't recall the last time people felt they were actually voting for someone rather than voting to eliminate something. But not everyone here accepts this logic of reformism. We workers who produce the wealth need to prove an alternative to this system, like the yellow vests do, through consciousness and organization.
Unions, notably quiet during the presidential campaign, were out in big numbers, though far from records. Police, normally elbow to elbow with protesters at yellow vest demonstrations, gave marchers plenty of room, with few serious confrontations reported. May Day 2019 is often considered the end of the major yellow vest demonstrations. Hundreds of arrests, warrantless searches starting from a 150-kilometer radius around Paris, and massive police violence gutted the average person's willingness to join 6 months of enormous anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The UN chief calls for a rapid return to civilian rule in Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali, which have recently experienced military coups. Antonio Guterres made the remark after meeting Senegalese President Macky Sall in Dakar. During the meeting, Guterres and Sall agreed on the need to keep talking to the de facto authorities in the three African countries in order to ensure a swift return to constitutional order. Sall is the current chair of West Africa's regional bloc, ECOWAS, that has suspended the three countries' membership over the coups. The bloc has also hit Mali with sanctions after the junta there rejected a rapid transition to civilian rule. ECOWAS threatened similar measures against Guinea and Burkina Faso.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him, and everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Teaching Prophet's Job. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Teaching and training means providing conditions for thriving and growing of talents and capacities in a creature. principally, the aim of education is to construct humans. Therefore, the ultimate goal of the divine prophets was to educate mankind. They were raised by God to guide human beings towards perfection, in a bid to take them to eternal happiness in afterlife. The prophets played the role of a gardener. In view of this, teachers are the followers of prophets if they guide their students correctly. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, "The first teacher is God, the Exalted, who takes people out of darkness into light and, by prophets and revelation, invites people to luminosity, perfection, love, and affection. After him, it is the prophets who promote the same divine school. Their job is also teaching, and they are the teachers of humans. Their job is to train humans so that he ascends from the status of animals and reaches the status of humanity. And after them, it is the teachers who are among humans. Teachers' job is the same job of Allah and the same job of prophets." Teaching is a very great job, an important job in the Islamic culture. The Noble Quran says in verse 32 of Surah Ma'idah, "Whoever saves a life is as though he had saved all mankind." Although the verse appears to speak about physical and material life, it also implies spiritual life. In other words, saving an individual from deviation and misguidance is in fact giving him or her life. Once a man came to the fourth infallible successor of the prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, and complained about the murderer of his father. He told the imam that he intended to retaliate and kill the man. Imam Sajjad asked him, "Hasn't this man rendered any service to you so that you take blood money instead of killing him?" The man told the imam that he had been his teacher for several days. Thus, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, said, "What are you saying? The value of teaching and guiding is more than blood and retaliation." Therefore, the man renounced retaliation. Teacher is the tool for learning and acquisition of knowledge. He or she is the one who causes individuals' intellect to grow. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Indeed, Allah, the angels and the inhabitants of earth, even the ants in its home and the fish in the sea, greet teachers who teach good things to people." May 2nd has been called Teachers' Day in Iran. The naming of this day dates back to 43 years ago, when one of the great and inexhaustible teachers of this country was assassinated by the agent of terrorist groups affiliated to the U.S. and Israeli regime. The teacher was the world-known professor and great philosopher of the 20th century, Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari. Martyr Mutahhari was born in 1919 in Fariman City, located some 75 kilometers southeast of Mashhad. Having finished his basic studies in his hometown, he left for Mashhad to continue his education in the seminary of Mashhad. In 1927, he left for Qom to complete his Islamic studies in spite of the tyrant Reza Khan's tough fight against ulema and seminaries. During his 25-year stay in Qom, Ayatollah Mutahhari attended the classes of Grand Ayatollah Hussein Borujerdi, Imam Khomeini, and Allama Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. In 1952, he left Qom for Tehran, although he had catapulted to fame as one of the great teachers and even future hopes of Qom Seminary. The great professor of Islamic sciences, Martar Motahhari, started writing of books and delivering constructive speeches in various fields of Islamic and social sciences. In 1955, he held the first session of interpretation of the Quran for university students. Very soon, the young generation was absorbed to his speeches, and the incorrect view on Islam was remarkably changed through his profound but simple speeches and classes. Ayatollah Motahhari writes, "Experience shows that whenever religion is separated from ethics, it is ethics that falls behind. None of the irreligious ethical school has been successful. For sure, religion is necessary for human ethics, at least as a support. The more religion and belief have been undermined, the more human ethics have declined. That's why we should consider extraordinary value for belief, at least as a support for ethics, if not the only guarantee for implementing it." From 1946, Martyr Ayatollah Motahhari authored valuable books in different fields of philosophy, social sciences, ethics, Islamic jurisprudence, Islamic history, education, and so on. More than 70 works were published from him. The most important feature of these works is that they focus on daily issues of society and answer many ambiguities and questions that were frequently asked by youths and families. His books and speeches were highly welcomed by university students and professors and intellectuals. Some of his works were published during his life, while others were published after his martyrdom. 43 years after the martyrdom of this great teacher of the 20th century, his name and fame has transcended countries and continents, and scores of his books have been translated into several languages. This great teacher had said before his martyrdom, "If I am to lose my life in the way of preventing perversion in Islam, let it be so, as this is the best kind of death."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly program that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how people in the subcontinent observe International Quds Day to reaffirm their solidarity with the oppressed people in Palestine. And we shall also take a look at how this day resonates with people in places like India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir in the context of their own struggles.
Four decades after the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini envisioned the day to reaffirm solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle for the liberation of occupied territories. Every year, on the last Friday of Ramadan, people across the world rally for the great cause. Some of the biggest international Quds Day rallies are witnessed in places such as India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir, where it also resonates with the people's own social and political struggles.
International Quds Day has over the years become synonymous with an action of solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine in their struggle for the liberation of the third holiest sanctuary for Muslims. But as Imam Khomeini quite clearly stressed back in 1979, the day is not exclusive to Palestine and Jerusalem, but seeks to raise awareness about oppression everywhere in the world. The message resonates loudly with people in places like India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir. In Afghanistan, for example, International Quds Day has for years been used as a psychological mechanism to mobilize masses against the US-led foreign military occupation that lasted 20 years, as well as terrorist groups like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In neighboring Pakistan, International Quds Day rallies see people chanting vociferous slogans against terrorist groups, including Daesh, Tehrik Taliban Pakistan, Lashkar Jangvi, as well as new imperial powers hell-bent on destabilizing the country. In India, the day resonates with people's struggle against the alarming rise in Islamophobia and the growing proximity between the ominous forces of Hindutva and Zionism. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, International Quds Day has become an important annual event to speak truth to power, to rally for freedom from all forms and manifestations of oppression and subjugation.
The Himalayan region of Kashmir is one of the places where International Quds Day is observed with unadulterated zeal. The Muslim-majority territory sees massive processions on the occasion, both to express solidarity with the people of Palestine and to give voice to their own sufferings. Quds Day has become a permanent feature on the annual calendar of Kashmir, where Imam Khomeini is deeply revered and his messages are followed in letter and spirit. The day also holds extra significance as the stories of Kashmir and Palestine run parallel to each other.
Every year, International Quds Day rallies are held in different parts of Indian-controlled Kashmir with massive participation. People cutting across sectarian and ideological lines take part in these rallies. Kashmir and Palestine have many things in common: the imposed war, military occupation, settler colonialism, and people without voice and agency. For years, Kashmiris have spoken in one voice against Israeli atrocities in the occupied Palestinian territories. On many occasions, people have been arrested in pro-Palestine demonstrations. For example, in June 2021, at least 21 people were taken into police custody in Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, for chanting pro-Palestine slogans. Among them was a mural artist who painted "We Are Palestine" and showed a woman with her head wrapped in a Palestinian flag. Pro-Palestine murals, graffiti, and slogans across the contested region show a shared sense of solidarity. Authorities fear these actions may lead to a wider socio-political movement against Indian rule in Kashmir. while India has rebuffed multiple UN resolutions calling for a plebiscite in Kashmir, Israel has brazenly dismissed numerous UN resolutions on Palestine's right to liberation from the Zionist occupation. But that has not prevented them from continuing their struggles and fighting on for their rights.
In Muslim-majority Pakistan, rallying for the cause of Palestine has become an article of faith for the people, while the position of successive governments also remains unchanged. On the International Quds Day, massive demonstrations are held in major cities such as Karachi, Lahore, Islamabad, and Peshawar, which also sees the participation of major political and religious organizations. Furthermore, it becomes an occasion for people in Pakistan to raise their voice against foreign interference in their own country and the wider region, in line with Imam Khomeini's immortal message.
When the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, called on the campaigners of truth and justice worldwide to commemorate the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as the Day of Al-Quds, people in Pakistan were among the first to stand up and take to the streets. Over the years, the tradition of expressing solidarity with the people of Palestine and other oppressed people on International Quds Day has been upheld with exemplary passion and conviction. The massive street rallies see the participation of people from all walks of life who march under one flag, the flag of resistance. These marches are generally organized by the National Solidarity Council of Pakistan, Majlis Wahdat-e-Muslimin Pakistan, and the Imamia Students Organization. These organizations have openly come out in support of the Palestinian resistance movements, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, while denouncing Arab countries for normalizing relations with the Israeli regime. International Quds Day also brings people in Pakistan together to denounce America's destabilizing activities in the country, as well as sponsorship of terrorist groups active in the region. The country has seen a surge of violence recently amid the resurgence of terrorist groups like Daesh and Tehrik Taliban Pakistan, who many observers believe are backed by Western spy agencies.
If you are a true Muslim and a believer in the oneness of God and the message of the Prophet, then you help everybody who is oppressed or weak. And you give them a hand when you can, you give them some material support when you can, and if you can't, you do with your prayers and your da'wah. Wherever there is a Muslim brother who is being oppressed or maltreated, we've got to stand up and try to help. Otherwise, the word ummah means nothing. And that is what Western colonization and Zionism have been trying to do for the last 100 years or so, to divide the ummah on the doctrine, divide and rule.
In India, which is the world's second most populous country, home to more than 10% of world Muslims, solidarity with the people of Palestine is deeply ingrained in the country's socio-political fabric. The International Quds Day generates tremendous enthusiasm in big Indian cities, with large street rallies participated by both Muslims and Hindus. This is while the government in New Delhi has in recent years drawn closer to Israel with lucrative defense deals, marking a departure from India's traditional position on the Palestine issue.
On International Quds Day every year, slogans like "Down with Israel" and "Down with the US" reverberate across India as thousands of people pour into the streets in solidarity with the people of Palestine and in protest to the occupation of the holy city of Al-Quds. Among the biggest gatherings is the one held at Jantar Mantar, a popular protest site in the heart of New Delhi. Cities with a sizable Muslim population, including Mumbai, Chennai, Hyderabad, and Lucknow, also see massive street rallies on the day, with the participation of people from both Muslim and Hindu communities. People in India have traditionally been staunch supporters of the Palestinian cause. However, the official Indian position on Israel's occupation of Palestine has seen a drastic change in recent years. In 1948, India was the only non-Muslim state to vote against the UN partition plan of Palestine. In the 1967 and 1973 wars, India denounced Israel as the aggressor. In the early 1990s, the policy began to change with the opening of the Indian embassy in Tel Aviv. Since 2014, when the Hindu nationalist BJP came to power, India has made its pro-Israel stance very clear, much to the chagrin of Indians who remain loyal to the Palestinian cause.
With all these people, they don't support anybody. They support their interests. I mean, Modi was dancing tango with Netanyahu in the open in the last few years. And now with the new advent of Ukraine, and people are sort of looking inwardly and saying, this is in the interest of my people, this isn't. And he is not supporting Palestine, he's supporting India. Like he said to America, no, I will not condemn Russia because they're offering me cheap oil. They were very, very open about it. Mercenary, yes, but this is politics, and this is modern politics, because unfortunately, since the Second World War, when America took the lead single-handedly ruling over the world, things have changed. No more principles, no more morals. It's gains and conquests and what you can get. And they've been doing it all over the world. Unfortunately, we in the Arab and Muslim world got our unfair share of American largesse at the point of a gun.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Wafiq Faour, an activist and member of Vermonters for Justice in Palestine. Now, welcome to the program, sir. As we know, almost 43 years after the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, gave the call for International Quds Day, the biggest rallies today are held in the Indian subcontinent. So what is it that brings people to the streets in such large numbers on this special day?
Ayatollah Khomeini, and with the definitely acceptance of the rest of the world, mainly the Palestinian movement, that time when he announced it, they are very welcoming, because we as Palestinians, we understand Al-Quds, quote-unquote Jerusalem, is not a Palestinian cause or an Arab cause only. It's a Muslim cause and it's an international cause. And every year, as I am observing it, I notice that it's becoming bigger, because Al-Quds is a central issue to all Muslims around the world. I think Khomeini was... he read the future more than anybody else, believing that Al-Quds going to be central to the Palestinian question, and the question between the survival of Israel as a colonial entity on the Middle East or the demise of that entity. And I believe he was futuristic and very, very smart to do what he did.
Mr. Faour, as you mentioned before, Imam Khomeini affirmed that this day is not exclusive to Palestine and Jerusalem, but is dedicated to all the oppressed across the world. So how does International Quds Day today resonate with people in places like India, Pakistan, Kashmir, and also Afghanistan?
I'm not going to deny that there is oppression everywhere. I mean, you mentioned on India, the Muslim region of Kashmir and Afghanistan in particular. I mean, oppression is all over the world. Those two are central as well. I believe there is no difference between our struggle and the Kashmir struggle, because they want independence and self-determination as the Palestinians. On Afghanistan, I think it's a little bit different, because I don't believe the American occupation of Afghanistan is obsolete yet, and still they have a hand of what's going on over there, including the changing of the government of Pakistan just recently. I believe you have forces in the Western world who are creating the modern colonialism, that they're not going to let go of what's going on. They will never accept losing the battle and the occupation of Afghanistan. They still have power within the Pakistani army and the Pakistani system. And maybe it will take time, but things are changing quickly, mainly after what's going on Ukraine and Russia. And I believe everything going parallels, and the effect of that war, we cannot predict it completely this early, on this early time.
Now, sir, in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, international Woods Day rallies have also focused on foreign interference and activities of Western-backed terrorist groups. This is while many see the hand of Western and its spy agencies behind the recent terrorist incidents in Afghanistan. So what's your assessment on this, Mr. Fowle?
You see, on Afghanistan, it is still not a free yet from 20 years of war from the American occupation. And I think they left many elements and created many elements similar that what they are creating on Syria, on Libya, on many parts of the Muslim world, that they still on the payroll of the American CIA and American forces. And I believe those forces and those terrorist group, those extremists, they are creating what we don't want to see on the Middle East. And it started before 9/11, but 9/11 was clear, because until now, we didn't read the full story of 9/11 and who created Osama bin Laden and those Wahhabi group, those extremists. But the world at one point will learn that much of extremism, it was a Western creation. American up front, but it had been supported by other Western forces as well.
Now, Mr. Fowle, what about India? People in India have traditionally been staunch supporters of the Palestinian cause, but the official Indian position has drastically altered in recent years. So why do you think that is?
The Indian government, as I read what's going on in Kashmir, they are extremists as well. The Hindu movement, they want to create a sectarian problem similar to what the West is creating in Afghanistan, on Syria, and in the Middle East. They want to divide the public based on their sect and their religious background. and they made the Sunnah Shia as a fight, and this is the struggle of what's going on the Middle East. The only beneficiary of this kind of division is the colonialist power that created and have been forced upon us from the West. This is the major problem, that some people bought to this idea that we are divided, even though our goals are the same. More things, 99%, I mean, Muslim, Sunnah or Shia, they believe on the same book, the same Muslim tradition. There isn't that division that the West have to like to highlight and to make it possible for them. The whole idea of creating this upheaval is to keep the West their foothold in our land.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Faour for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Kashmir-based photojournalist Sayed Shahriar shares pictures taken at the International Quds Day rally in Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, in 2019, before the COVID-19 pandemic broke out. Dr. Hafizur Rahman, a New Delhi-based university professor and author, says he addressed the International Quds Day gathering at Jantar Mantar, a popular protest site in the heart of the Indian capital. Pakistani social media activist Sheikh Salim Ahmad notes that Pakistan has always supported the Palestinian cause, sharing pictures from International Quds Day rally held in Faisalabad city. Mirway Salamzoy, an Afghan journalist, asserts that oppression faced by Palestinians is akin to the oppression faced by all Muslims, adding that preparations are afoot for observing International Quds Day in Afghanistan. Kashmir-based university student Farooq Farhan shares a picture taken at the International Quds Day rally in Tehran to suggest that the day seeks to raise awareness about all oppressed people worldwide.
And that was our special episode about the International Quds Day, support for the Palestinian cause, and how it resonates with people's own struggles against injustice in the South Asian region. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight. The definition of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. So ruled the veteran Washington journalist Michael Kinsley, who would surely take delight in the textbook example of the form served up on Thursday, 28th of April, by Jacob Rees-Mogg, the satirically titled Minister for Brexit Opportunities. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland. The piece is titled, Jacob Rees-Mogg Has Given the Game Away. Even this government knows Brexit is a disaster. The definition of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. So ruled the veteran Washington journalist Michael Kinsley, who would surely take delight in the textbook example of the form served up on Thursday, 28th of April, by Jacob Rees-Mogg, the satirically titled Minister for Brexit Opportunities. On a visit to the Eurotunnel terminal at Folkestone, high-visibility gilet over his double-breasted suit, Jacob Rees-Mogg announced that the government was delaying yet again the imposition of post-Brexit border checks on imports from the European Union. He asked the public to celebrate this decision on the grounds that it would save £1 billion a year and help hard-pressed consumers by avoiding an increase in the cost of imported food. Enforcing post-Brexit checks, said the minister, would have been an act of self-harm. You read that right. Jacob Rees-Mogg, the arch-leaver and long-time loather of the European Union, is now parroting lines from the Remain campaign. He's admitting that implementing Brexit in full, honouring the 2016 promise to take back control of Britain's borders, would be an act of self-harm. There's plenty to attack here, starting with the nerve of hailing this move as saving Britain's £1 billion, when this was £1 billion that Britons would never have had to spend at all if it hadn't been for Brexit. Or you could share the outrage of British farmers, appalled that thanks to Brexit, they have been left at a serious competitive disadvantage. They now face onerous and costly checks when they ship their goods across the Channel, while French, Italian and Spanish farmers face no such hassle moving their farm produce in the other direction. Or you could worry along with the British Veterinary Association, which warns that not checking food imports leaves Britain exposed to catastrophic animal diseases, such as African swine fever, a risk that was reduced when Britain was part of the European Union's integrated and highly responsive